So I think you all know Bhante Sidharto very well, but I'll just briefly introduce our speaker as well. So Bhante's been a monastic for, and hi everyone online, welcome. Wonderful to see so many people here tonight. So these talks are every Friday and available online as well now. So Bhante's been a monastic for about 30 years. He started training in Thailand in the Ajahn Chah tradition. He also trained with Ajahn Brahm, and he was the abbot of Santi Forest Monastery for about 10 years. It's a beautiful place in the Southern Highlands. Highly recommend visiting. It's now a nun's monastery. Also, Bhante's, done countless talks and retreats and published a lot of books. I just found these. I'm cleaning my bookshelf, actually. These are some of your fiction books.
Nice.
Yeah, Harbingers and Beginnings.
Harpies, can I have one? I haven't seen this one for years.
So he's published widely, including fiction, some really interesting stuff, highly recommended. And, he's also translated the suttas into contemporary English, and they're available on suttacentral.net. It's quite fantastic because they're without any copyright, they're freely accessible. So I might just keep it at that, actually, because my voice is getting hoarse. Okay, thank you, everyone. And like I said, it's fine if you need anything.
No, Lucy, you can have your books back.
Sorry.
You can hand them around. So the Harbingers you can order online.
Harbingers you can order online. It's an awesome cli-fi novel about enlightenment and apocalypse. Cli-fi? That, funnily enough, okay, when I was doing research for this book, I walked into the bookshop and they said, can you show me your cli-fi section? And that's what they said as well. What's cli-fi? Yeah, it's sci-fi, but it's about climate change. So this is a novel about... Sorry?
How are we going down?
Or in ice. Excellent question. So the apocalypse in the Harbingers, by the way, that photo is a real photo. That was from the bushfires, and the Black Sunday bushfires. And the apocalypse in the Harbingers is an all of the above apocalypse. So it features every possible kind of disaster happening at once. Sorry? Yes, that's correct. And yes, so it's set about a group of survivors who managed to somehow live and maybe even get enlightened. Who knows? Who knows? I don't know. You'd have to read the book.
No way.
No spoilers.
Right? And... okay, so that's that. And the other one that was showed, Beginnings, this is a very fun book. Can I just show the folks online this book just very briefly? Sorry, I'll get back. This Beginnings, this is a book I did many years ago with a local artist, Lisa Ann, who's Singaporean of origin but was working in Sydney. And so she did all of the, she worked with her students and they did all of the typesetting and all of the graphics and all of these kinds of things. So this is a retelling of the Buddhist stories of the origin of the world, the Aganya Sutta. And so this is found in the Digha Nikaya. And so we wanted to try to present in a way that would be fun and interesting and so on. So we made that little book. This is published quite some time ago and it's not available for reprint at the moment. So good luck finding that. All right. Okay, and now for something completely different, I'm going to invite Venerable Kusalachara to say a few words in Spanish for our Spanish-speaking members in the audience, of whom I know there is at least one.
Okay, I don't need to say it. Bienvenidos. Espero que encuentren esta plática de dama muy iluminadora. ¿Cuántos... Spanohablantes hay el día de hoy? Una? Okay. So that's it for today.
Gracias. Gracias.
Gracias. Okay, very good. Excellent. So let us begin with reciting the words of homage to the Triple Gem. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ sammasambuddho vidha charana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasarathi Sattha deva manusanam buddho Svakato bhagavata nammo Sandirthiko akaliko Ehipasiko opanayiko Pachatam veditabo vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho Ujupatipanno bhagavato Nyaya patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Samichi patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho Iyadidam chattari purisa yugani Atapurisa puggala Esa bhagavato savaka sangho Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakirneyo Anjali karaneyo Anuttarang punyaketang lokasati Sadhu. Okay, very good. And so today here in Crow's Nest, we are joined by our, in the Crow's Nest Centre next door, in the next door room, we're joined by our lovely local Baha'i community who's sort of celebrating their, I think, Baha'i birthday of the founder. And I've had a long connection with the Baha'i community in Sydney. And I just wanted to mention them because Baha'i, I think, originated or at least has a strong basis in Iran. And of course, we all know the horrifying violence that's unfolding due to the invasion or attack on Iran by America and Israel. And so many people suffering there. And we hear casualty figures and so on. A group like the Baha'is have already been suffering from persecution. Their leaders have been unjustly imprisoned for many years, and they had, like a lot of religious minorities in Iran, have been suffering from persecution already. And then when you have war on top of it, then just spare a thought for all of those people who are just really going through it. And it's for us living here in a nice, safe, comfortable society like Australia, our fuel prices go up and we're complaining. And look, fair enough, cost of living is high in Australia, but it's all relative. So, yeah. Anyway, may they be happy, and may in these kinds of conflicts always the people who suffer, and they didn't do anything wrong, and yet somehow they're the ones who bear the brunt. So as Dhamma practitioners and as, well, I guess decent human beings, and we just wish for all people to live in peace and shake our heads. So if speaking for myself, I shake my head in wonder and confusion at how we keep forgetting to learn the same lesson over and over again. Anyway, okay, so how about we do, should we do some meditation? What do you think?
Yes.
Okay, good. One of these days you're all going to say no. You know, I did this one class in Singapore. They asked me to do this teacher's class at a primary school, or no, a secondary school. I'm like, okay. They said, this is the worst class in Singapore. Okay. They said, like everyone who gets kicked out of every other school and every other class ends up in this class. Okay. Do you still want to come and teach it? I said, sure. So go along. I pulled out every ghost story, right? Every tiger story. Okay. Everything that I could think of. Nothing. Completely blank. No, and then I'm at the end, I'm like, oh, does anyone have any questions? With one voice, no. Okay, well, I tried. Anyway. What an awesome ringtone. How can I get that ringtone for my phone? Okay, we got that? Okay, so look, thank you so very much for that that ringtone and for reminding us of suffering and impermanence. But just we've got the lesson now, so we don't need to learn it again. So if you could turn off your phones, then that would be great. Or not, whatever. All right. All right, so we're going to do some meditation. Let's do some mindfulness of breathing. And for this session, I'll offer a few reflections on mindfulness of breathing before we begin the meditation. Now, it's interesting that in the suttas, we have many different kinds of meditation, traditionally 40 different kinds, actually probably much more than that, and many different like approaches and reflections and so on. But of all of them, mindfulness of breathing is one that sort of we keep coming back to. And it's one that the Buddha said is very pure and very doesn't have any side effects or bad effects. Buddha gave a simile like a wind that blows the leaves before it. Mindfulness of breathing is like a clear breath of air that blows away all of our anxieties, all of our troubles, all of our defilements. So when we practice mindfulness of breathing, the number one thing to bear in mind is that this is not, it's nothing personal. It's not about you. And it's not an experiment. People have been doing this for thousands of years, even long before the Buddha, people were doing this meditation. it's a very, like, you can't exactly say that any practice is completely universal. I'm sure that there are some people for whom mindfulness of breathing is not going to be suited. But for almost everyone, mindfulness of breathing is a very good meditation. It's very easy to teach mindfulness of breathing. Mindfully breathe in, mindfully breathe out. And honestly, that's all you really need to know. If there's a downside to mindfulness of breathing or a catch, it's that it tends to be, not always, but tends to be somewhat slow as a meditation. Now, other meditations that maybe you feel results from more quickly, like sometimes you can do a meditation like, let's say, a recollection of the Buddha. And if you're a very faithful person, you can do recollection of the Buddha and then you can feel a lot of joy very quickly. And you feel, oh, it feels so uplifting to do that meditation. Or for some people, doing metta meditation is the same. You can start it and you feel so much joy from doing metta meditation. Whereas when you do mindfulness of breathing, sometimes you can do it and then you reach the end and you're like, what was that about? Nothing seemed to really happen. So it can be like that. Now, this isn't a problem with the meditation, but it does mean that you need patience. Actually, when it comes to meditation and mental development, slow is good. Yeah, slow is good. Because our minds and our bodies don't just change like that. They are organic. They grow. When the Buddha was talking about the mind, he didn't use, these days people use mechanistic metaphors to talk about the mind. Mind's like a computer or these kinds of things. In those days, the Buddha said the mind is like a seed. It's nurtured and it grows. The mind is like a tree. The mind is like something which is complex. It has all of these networks in it. And so because of that, you can't just make it be different. You have to grow it and train it. So one of the one of the lessons that I learned about this, I learned from a farmer called Masanobu Fukuoka. And some of you may know Fukuoka, One Straw Revolution, and a very famous book that he wrote about organic farming and so on. So he was a Zen contemplative and so on. And very interesting book and a lot of very interesting reflections. So basically he inherited a farm from his father. Everybody was like driving tractors around their farms and pouring petrochemicals on them and so on. And he wanted to try to find a different way of doing it. And to do that, because he didn't have any models, he had to experiment. And then he learned about things along the way. So there are two. I'm going to tell you two stories from his book that give you completely the opposite lesson. Okay, so one story was that part of the farm that he inherited was an orchard of nashi pear trees. And we all know nashi pears, yum. Crispy and juicy and sweet, delicious, but they have to be cultivated in a very specific way. So in Japan, they were all cultivated so that the trees were cut at the top and the branches were all bent down so that the fruit pickers could pick the fruit. So that the tree was actually grown for the benefit of the humans who were taking the fruit rather than for the tree itself. So Fukuoka looked at that and he thought, that doesn't look very good. And he thought, I'll let the trees go back to nature. I'll let them find their own natural way. So they all had like wires on them and so on. Actually, when my father got his property up in Coffs Harbour, he also had a nashi orchard on that property. And so I've seen this for myself, how they put the wires on it and so on. So he thought, well, I'll take all that stuff off and I'll let them find their natural form. And he took everything off and it was a disaster. Because all of the branches became crossed, everything became twisted, and the whole orchard was ruined because nothing would grow properly or grow straight because it had already been pulled out of its natural shape. And he didn't know what the natural shape of a nashi pear tree was because there simply weren't any. They were all pulled out of this way. There were no farms that had a naturally growing nashi pear tree. So he had to have a long process of trial and error to train them back into their natural shape. Right? So you can imagine that's taking many years, right, to figure out how they're going to do this and to bring them into their natural shape. So this is one lesson. And this is, I think, an important lesson. We touched on this when we were talking a bit earlier, Venerable, when we were talking about like that people are very traumatized. And so when we come to meditation or something, our mind has already been bent out of shape. And we already have our minds have been pushed and pressed and stressed and traumatized. And somehow we have to find a way to bring our mind back into a natural shape. But it's not obvious, because we too have never really seen what that natural shape of our mind is. And we don't really know how to get from here to there. So that takes a process. So this is one story. The second story was a story about a swarm of locusts. So Fukuoka was growing rice, and locusts descended and started eating the rice, plague of locusts. He looked out and he thinks, oh, that's not good. And he looked around him, all the farmers around, and they immediately got out there on their tractors and started spraying poison to kill all the locusts. And he looked at them, and he looked at the locusts eating his rice, and he thought, I don't really know what to do. So he went inside, got a pot of honey and a spoon, and sat under a tree and ate honey with a spoon while watching the locusts eating his rice. Seems like a fairly reasonable reaction. And he did that for like one or two days. And then on the third day, he came out in the morning and he was stunned, because overnight, thousands and thousands of tiny spiders had appeared as if from nowhere. And they had spun webs and they were catching all of the locusts. And he'd never seen these spiders before. He didn't know that they were there. And he looked around at all the other farms. Of course, they'd killed all the spiders because they'd been spraying the pesticides. And the spiders ended up catching most of the locusts. The rest of them left. And only a small portion of his crop ended up being damaged. So this was another lesson, right? So that other lesson is that, well, sometimes you just watch and you just wait and things will find their own solution. Yeah. So these are two different stories with two different lessons. Sometimes you have to get involved and fix things. Sometimes you have to just watch and wait and things will fix themselves, all right? That's not very helpful, is it? How do you know? Well, you know because, number one, mindfulness is always useful. Right? So the Buddha said this in the Bodhanga Sutta, mindfulness is always useful. So that means that mindfulness is telling you what is going on. So you could see what Fukuoka was doing in that second story. He was being mindful, watching, not in a hurry to come to a conclusion, right? Because he knew that he did not know, right? This is also a very important point about that story. He knew that he did not know. And as the Buddha said, and also, as Socrates said, that's the first sign of wisdom, right? A wise person who knows that they do not know is wise at least to that extent. It's from the Dhammapada and some guy called Socrates, I don't know, whatever. But so we wait and we watch and we observe, and then our wisdom gradually learns to understand what's happening. This is what we do at the end of the meditation when we reflect back and we review the meditation. So we learn to understand what is going on. And sometimes that will tell us that there are self-balancing mechanisms and processes in the mind so that things will work out and we don't really have to do anything. But other times it will tell us that, no, actually there's a persistent pattern where, like, when I sit down to meditate, this same thing happens all the time. Maybe my mind persistently is drifting towards thoughts of hatred and vengeance against somebody that I dislike. Yeah? Or maybe you get into a habit of falling asleep every time you meditate. And so there's a persistent pattern. So your mindfulness learns to recognize it and your wisdom understands I need to do something about it. Then your energy, okay, I am going to do something about it. And you commit yourself to do it until you can overcome that problem. So this is a couple of reflections that I found very useful for understanding the process of meditation. So let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation. So sitting quietly. And letting the mind settle back into your body. And becoming aware of the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And when your mind wanders off, just be aware of it. Ah, okay, my mind's wandering. And bring it back and let that soothing rhythm of the breath calm you down. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. So now coming near to the end of the meditation. I want you to take a minute to reflect back over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself, what was your mind like at the start of the meditation? What did your body feel like? What did your breath feel like? How did that change during the course of the meditation? And what kinds of things were supporting you in the practice? What kinds of things were taking you away from the practice? How do your mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so let's have a bit of a break, grab a cup of tea, and then we can come back for the Dhamma talk. Yeah.
Sorry?
All
right.
Oh, bit of attachment to
that.
Yeah.
I'm invested in the story.
Oh, that, you should read that one. Yeah, that one you can order online. Yeah.
I like sharing this.
Right? Yeah.
When somebody else is like, that
shouldn't go. Right? Hey everyone, how are we going? We have sound back? Excellent. Okay, so we have a couple of Spanish speakers online also saying hi. So this is good. Okay. Actually, I had a couple of thoughts in mind for what I might talk about for the Dhamma talk today, but I don't know if anybody has any suggestions or anything they'd like to hear a Dhamma talk about. Tessa's asked, no, not Tessa, sorry. All right. Marion and Tessa have both asked a question from Europe. How's it going, Marion? So I'll answer these couple of questions, and then if you have some thoughts after that, then we'll see if I can respond to them. Otherwise, I did have a couple of things in mind. We'll see. All right, so Marion asks, Dear Bhante, what is bhavo in Upadana Pachaya bhavo? Is it the whole group of sankhara choices, actions taken as a whole in their dynamic? Is it replicating by itself like a broken record? Is the translation life correct? Oh, dear, Marion, that's really getting right into it. So I think you and probably many people around here would know, but I'll just mention again that during the last Rains retreat, so for like 3 months of last year, I did a whole series on dependent origination, including this particular phrase. So those are all on lokanta.live, right, Michael? Should be right. And so you can check out the relevant one for that. But I'm going to go take these questions in the reverse order. Is the translation life for bhava correct? So the literal meaning of bhava is existence or being, and life is often a pretty good translation. So it's one of those words that the connotations are a little bit, similar but also a bit different than in English. So if you have, for example, passages like nate bhavangatamangadiyanti, they don't take up an eighth life, meaning an eighth rebirth. That's talking about the stream enterer. So in that case, life is quite a good translation of bhava. That's certainly one of the possible translations. Is it replicating by itself like a broken record? Oh, interesting analogy there. Yeah, I guess so. Like bhava in a way contains everything else. So bhava or existence or life is everything else. So it's got this whole energy that's going in there. Yeah, I guess you could say like a broken record. But it's not like repeating exactly the same, right? It repeats but also changes. So the simile or the image that I like to use for this is the image of the spiral. So life doesn't repeat exactly, but it repeats patterns. And the patterns follow a similar course, but they don't repeat exactly. Speaking of which, recent research just came out. They just found all the five base nucleotides on an asteroid. I don't know if anybody saw that. Awesome.
You know what that means, don't you?
Tell me, what does that mean?
Well, the implications are that there's, potential for life in space.
Life? It means that life maybe came from somewhere else, right? Which it kind of weird. I found it weird, right, that life is so persistent that it can even cross the vast expanses of space and potentially seed life forms in other planets and systems and so on. Yeah, incredible. Anyway, science is amazing. Go on, yeah.
A good question. It's where the Buddhist belief, where does the human or the human soul?
Right. But the human soul. Okay, good. We're going to come back to that.
Like the original soul.
The original soul. We're going to come back to that again.
Where does the rest of us come from?
Where does that come from? Where does the original soul come from? Yeah. I'm going to come back to that, okay? Okay, so I'm going to just finish off Marian's questions. Is the whole group of sankhara choices, actions taken as a whole in their dynamic? That's another way of thinking about it. So bhava means existence, but it doesn't mean existence in a static sense. It's a dynamic conception of existence, which always means like those things that are creating, the forces of creation as well as the forces of destruction and all of those things. So in some ways, one of the ways of thinking about bhava is that bhava is kind of like an individual bhava is kind of like a point on a spectrum, or like so that when you get reborn, You like get rebirth is a bit like, and this is just an analogy, but rebirth is a bit like tuning into a particular frequency. So you like tune into the human frequency where you're sort of mostly around there, but it's an organic process. So you're not like fixed exactly that way, you kind of vary a lot. And the human realm can vary quite a bit in terms of, like, you know, you can meditate and become much more pure and elevated, or you can, well, do the other thing and go down much further. So there's quite a lot of variation within that, but you tend to be around that level in the spectrum for the human life. Then if you get reborn, maybe you go down, maybe you go up, and then you tend to have a new kind of base frequency for that particular realm. So that's one way of thinking about Bhava.
Can I ask a question?
You can ask a question. We've got questions piling up now. Good.
I have one brief comment and one question. Please bear in mind, I get very enthusiastic. Do you tell me to when to stop talking? And I say sorry.
I will. Yeah.
Okay. I get very enthusiastic. So I understand when you're talking about your life from outer space.
No, it's just the implication.
The implication.
Potential.
Well.
Because there are other ways to explain it.
Of course. Mm. I mean, if you want to look at it from the Buddhist literature, and I know there's I think it's more pronounced from what I gather in the Mahayana scriptures about the Bodhisattvas, and they also, you have also the legend of the Nagas, who are meant to be, some of them are beings from off this planet, and then the Buddha can incarnate in countless of different worlds, and that implies other planets meeting other beings. And I say this more with hesitation, but then it's implying aliens. And if that were true, I'm someone who does believe in the scriptures, then those things do exist. And therefore, how can we, as a single speck, think of William Blake's poem, I think, to hold infinity in an hour, to hold your Parmenahan, I'm paraphrasing, basically said it was one speck of dust in this vast, you know, universe, and other universes becoming all the living beings on this planet. So that was my comment.
Thank you.
The second thing I was going to ask was, I forgot, so it's not necessary. It wasn't.
No worries. If it comes back to you, we've got a few more questions and so on here.
For your compassion and understanding of patience.
No, no problem. Okay, so hang on, I'm just coming back to Marianne's one, the whole group. So I think we've addressed most of those things. Sorry, your question again was?
Where does, like, what's the original soul?
The original soul, okay, nice. Okay, I like that question. Okay, so in Buddhism, we don't have a soul, nor do we have an original, okay? So we don't really think about it in those terms, but we think about it in terms of processes, in terms of networks, in terms of streams, yeah? What's the Buddhist version of Adam and Eve? Okay, so the Buddha said that anamadago ko ayang sangsaro, the pubbakoti na panyayati. There's this sangsara, this rolling on in rebirth, this transmigration in rebirth, has no known beginning, right? No known beginning. He didn't say it has no beginning as such, no known beginning. So it's an epistemological statement. It's about the limits of knowledge, yeah? And there's no first point at which we can say before this was nothing and then after there was something. So the Buddha didn't make a claim about what the origin of things was, but he did make a claim to say that essentially that those who claim to say they know what the origin is don't really know. Yeah. Yeah. And this is, we make up stories, we didn't make up that story. So that actually has a precedent. So this is one of my favorite, we were talking just a bit earlier about the ways that Buddhism relates to ideas around it and the ideas that came before it. Now that idea that you can, that we don't know what the origin of it was. Now if you come from a Western point of view, from a biblical point of view, then that's, you know, it's crazy because that's like literally the whole theme of the whole beginning, let there be light and so on and so forth. And I did, by the way, also do a whole talk, I think, in the Rains Retreat about the parallels between the book of Genesis and dependent origination. So you can check that one out. So that's also fun. But in an Abrahamic context, that's taken for granted. But what's interesting is in the Indian context, that even long before the Buddha, in a book called the Rig Veda, we're talking maybe 500 years before the Buddha, who knows, maybe earlier, there's a poem called the Nausadiya Sukta, and it talks, it says who was there in the beginning, where did all this come from, how did all of this start, and it discusses about the origin of things, right? But then it says, like, what? But then before all of these things, what was there? The gods don't know, because they were created afterwards, right? So they wouldn't know. So who knows? Only he knows. Only he who sits in the highest heaven and surveys all from there, from above, knows. Or perhaps even he doesn't know. So this is right from that beginning, right from 3,000 years ago, they're acknowledging that maybe there are limits to what is known and what is knowable. So from a Buddhist point of view, we don't make any definitive statements about that. So what we do say, and so this book here, Beginnings, is about that, actually. And it tells the story of a particular discourse called the Aganya Sutta, which is the closest that we come to a creation myth in Buddhism. And the first line of the Aganya Sutta is right here. For those online, there comes a time when the world ends. Yeah? Hotiko panasamayo. So that's the first line of the Buddhist creation myth. There comes a time when the world ends. So that's the Buddhist creation myth, begins with the end of the world. And from a Buddhist point of view, that ending, of course, is not an absolute ending, but it's another turn of the cycle. So the Buddhist view is that the world is in a perpetual state of dying and regenerating, and that we can't speak of the ultimate beginning of things, but we can speak about the beginnings of this turn of the wheel, if you like.
So within the consciousness, if I can express it that way, consciousness that the Buddha kind of acquired through the witnessing of suffering, is that in a way the birth of the current cycle, speaking like generally, not just the lifetime?
So could you just say that again for me?
Is the consciousness kind of that awareness like the comparison to when, like, if it's the appointment, they become conscious. Is that equivalent when the Buddha witnesses suffering in the world?
Yeah.
And that creates his awareness of himself and kind of the world more at large? Was that the birth, so to speak, of Buddhism on this cycle?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, so Buddhism is originated, if I understand your question correctly, so according to Buddhism, because there's these cycles, and that means that there are always beings, and as you said, aliens, right? Aliens are completely normal in Buddhism. We obviously expect that there's going to be aliens out there. That's like not even a problem. And from time to time, right, because they're just beings like us, from time to time, they will ask themselves, what the hell is going on? And they will figure out, why am I suffering all the time? And why is it that everyone that I love dies? And so from time to time, people will then, what we would call, become enlightened.
That's the exposure to the suffering. But if we're not exposed to it, we're kind of, not the way of heaven, develop the full consciousness.
Right. If we're not exposed to suffering, then we don't develop that full consciousness. Yes, that would be true. Yeah. So we can be hidden from the true nature of suffering. So what we call moha, or delusion. So delusion hides the true nature of suffering from us. Yeah. And we can, that obviously that can go on for a long time for many people. So that awakening occurs as a natural process for people from time to time. But only occasionally does the person who become awakened then start what we call dispensation, or start to teach broadly and establish the religion of Buddhism or the dispensation of Buddhism. But that happens in samsara, in the course of transmigration, every so often. So Gautama Buddha, the historical Buddha, is the one who started that in our time. So that's 2,500 years ago. So historically speaking, then there wasn't any Buddhism before that. But that doesn't mean that there weren't any awakened beings or great sages. In fact, the Buddhist texts list 100 or more of sages who were in the time before the Buddha, but they just didn't start that wheel of the Dhamma.
No? I understand that you had the Jataka details, which are the past incarnations of the Buddha.
Right.
Which,
yeah, yeah.
Which almost like Hindu principles kind of thing. Sorry.
Yeah. So just to come back to your other question about the soul. So in Buddhism, we don't really talk about soul because the soul has an implication of something which is substantial and eternal. Right? So in Buddhism, we have things, we have a process which continues and which is renewed, but which is always changing. So the Buddha would talk about, say, the stream of consciousness. And so like a stream of water, it's not a self-same identical thing, but it's a process which is always moving and changing. Does that make sense?
I heard you, but I didn't get it.
You heard, but you didn't get it. Yeah, thank you.
Between the consciousness and kind of putting the word soul to that consciousness.
Okay, so what's the difference between consciousness and putting the word soul to it? So when we talk about consciousness, we're talking about something that we can observe, right? We can close our eyes, we can look in our mind, we say, well, what are we conscious of? And we can see what we're conscious of and we can observe that and reflect on it. But when we talk about a soul or a self in that metaphysical sense, we add to that properties that we can't observe. So, for example, the property of being eternal, right?
Isn't that what reincarnation is?
No. Reincarnation is a process of ongoing change.
But the change which comes with the
yeah.
In each cycle.
Yeah.
What exactly is being reborn?
What exactly is being reborn?
Is it your consciousness?
Yeah.
Or is it a soul spirit type of?
Again. So it's your consciousness. So the what is reborn, or the process of rebirth, is the same process that you can observe right here and now. You observe your own consciousness, your own mind, sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, your own desires, your own fears, and so on. And that process continues to go. We don't evoke some special metaphysical entity to explain that process.
Is consciousness purely reserved for humans?
Is consciousness, I'm just going to repeat the four online, but is consciousness purely reserved for humans? No. All beings have consciousness.
Well, is a grain of sand considered?
Controversial question. So in Buddhism, generally speaking, in Buddhism, inanimate objects don't have consciousness, but in Jainism they do. So this is one philosophical difference between Buddhism and Jainism. Jainism believed that all substance had consciousness to some degree.
With each reincarnation, ideally you move forward and upwards,
right.
But sometimes you regress.
Right.
So if you regress, you come back as a rock. Then where is the consciousness there?
Okay, so you can't come back. According to Buddhism, you can't be reborn as a rock. You could be reborn as a jellyfish.
Okay, so like a Mugyani.
Yeah, yeah.
So a jellyfish would then have consciousness.
Presumably, yeah. Please.
Well, you said there's no known stuff.
Yes.
Consciousness.
Yes.
How can we be sure of the end of it, even enlightenment? Because if there's no star, how can we be sure? And does enlightenment mean like you just get comfortable with the state of being, or does it actually mean like a cessation of everything?
You see what I have to deal with. Thank you. That's a very good question. Excellent question. So, so the question was about the ending of things. So, if we don't know that if we can't say whether there's a first beginning of things, can we say whether there's an actual ending of things? And how do we know when we get enlightened? So, according to Buddhism, when you get enlightened, then that means an ending of suffering, which means an ending of rebirth through this process of samsara. But how do you know that, right? How do you know? What do you think?
From what I've read from the suttas of you know, people are feeling enlightened beings just become comfortable with suffering.
Enlightened, you think enlightened beings become comfortable with suffering, okay?
Yes, like just the state of existence. I don't know whether they actually, because it says a lot like deathlessness, you know.
Right.
They're aiming for that. But does it mean like a mental deathlessness or just like a physical deathlessness? Like, what does it mean?
Okay, so do enlightened beings just become comfortable with suffering? In a way, yes. So when somebody becomes enlightened, so we talk about somebody who's fully enlightened, we call an arahant, okay? So according to Buddhism, just a bit of background here. So according to Buddhism, we have a path. That path leads to the ending of suffering. That ending of suffering unfolds in four distinct stages: stream entry, once return, non-return, and arahant. And the last stage of that is an arahant, when they have completely let go of all of those defilements, cravings, and attachments that lead towards generating suffering and generating rebirth. All right? That's an arahant. Now, so the Buddha was an arahant, okay? And many disciples were also arahants. So they finished the work, katakaraniyo. They had nothing more to do. And they were completely disconnected from anything unwholesome that would create suffering, okay? In a way, yes. Is that dissolution of being human? Depends how you define being human, yes.
So all of those desires and suffering, funny thing,
like you say, ending of being human, so no greed, hatred, and delusion. Funny thing, if you meet spirit, I'm not going to say if you meet arahants, because I'm not somebody who's going to go around judging people, right? But I've met people in my life who, when you see them, they're the most alive people that you've ever seen. And they are full of wit and humor. And I met one monk in northeast Thailand called Lumpur Dun. And he was a very funny monk. He just lived by himself in the forest for years. And he had this very, very great reputation and so on. And we went to see him. And he was just always kind of cracking jokes and telling stories. And he was almost dead. He was just like lying on his bed. He could hardly even get up, you know. I mean, he could get up, but not really very much. But, yeah, so when you say, does it mean the end of being human, my experience is that when you practice a path, you become more alive, more vibrant, more human.
Or maybe we were never humans in the first place, being enlightened. Maybe we only truly become humans once we attain nirvana.
Hmm.
It's just a different way to be.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's the right answer.
Yeah. Okay. So how do you know it's the end, right? So you know it's the end because of your understanding of causality, because your understanding of how things work. All right? So you think about, like, say, a scientist, right? So a scientist would know, oh, this is not going to happen. Why? Because I understand cause and effect. Or even a mechanic, right? Mechanics and look at your car and say, this is hopeless, this is not going to work. Why? Because I understand how engines work. And they know you can get in the car and try to start it up, it's not going to start up because they understand it. So the same thing is, an arahant understands cause and effect by observing their own mind, and they observe how suffering originates and how it ends, and they understand that those things that give rise to suffering no longer exist.
Even if it's not working, like,
right. So the arahant still exists for that time being. And while the arahant still exists, they feel suffering. Okay? So arahants aren't completely free of suffering in this life. In fact, an arahant has plenty of kinds of suffering. An arahant gets a sore back. The Buddha got a sore back. He'd be like, ow, my back's sore. And they have to sit in the sun, and somebody, he wouldn't really complain about being out, but he would sit in the sun and have his sore back and so on. And so even more subtle forms of suffering arahants have as well. So, but what they don't have is emotional suffering, because they're not reacting towards it. So what you said about, are you just comfortable with suffering? Yes, an arahant is comfortable with the suffering that they have. Like, they accept it, they know that this is happening, and they can let it go. So it doesn't make them mentally suffering. They just have the physical suffering. But when an arahant dies, then there's no more suffering at all.
The metaphor of the candle being blown out.
Uh-huh. What does it look like when an arahant dies? Is it like a candle being blown out? Sure, yeah.
Well, that doesn't really mean much to me. disappearing?
It means that the candle is burning, and so it's hot, and it's full of change and all of those things, and that no longer is the case.
I'm just wondering, why didn't the Buddha say the start of this mind was due to causation?
Why didn't the Buddha say the start of the mind was due to causation?
The end is the cessation of.
Okay. Thank you. Another good question. I'm sorry.
You need coffee?
I'm sorry. Okay. So this, for that particular question, we need to, or it's useful for me to think of it to again compare it to theology. Now, if we look at it from a biblical perspective or a Catholic perspective, right? God created the world, blah blah blah. Let there be light. He didn't say blah blah blah. He said let there. Or maybe he did, but they edited that bit out because probably he said that. He's probably sitting down there saying, oh, blah, 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 what am I going to do now? Anyhow, whatever. So he created the world, okay? But then who created God? Right? What was God doing before he created the world? Right? So you think you have an answer to that question, but what you in fact have is just another question. Martin Luther gave a good response to that question. When somebody asked him, what was God doing before he created the world? Martin Luther said he was sitting in a forest making birch rods with which to hit people who ask an impertinent question. So that's one possibility. So from a Catholic point of view or Christian point of view, you end up with this idea of what they call the prime mover, like an uncaused cause, which is always quite philosophically incoherent because none of the things that we observe, the things that we observe as causes were always caused. We can never observe anything that causes, but is it not itself caused? And that's a hypothesis, which then you have to make about the nature of God, to say that God causes but is not himself caused. And so, again, this is one of those metaphysical problems with that idea of God. So this is why in Buddhism we don't get into that trap. So this is why the Buddha was very specific and very cautious about those things, like not overstepping the bounds of the things that he could say. Yeah, not falling into the temptation of pretending that he knew all the answers to everything. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Sashi.
So, like, what would they say? Enlightenment was like a nihilism as well, right? Like, because I haven't read all the things, but when I was looking at it, it's not like he's saying, well, it's like a end of the world as such as well. Like, he doesn't. It's not very clear as to where
So the question is, thank you for that. The question is enlightenment is not also not nihilism, and it's not the end of the world. Okay, so I'm going to take both of those two things in turn. So first of all, nihilism can be understood really in two ways. So often we understand nihilism in a emotional sense. So nihilism is like nothing that I do matters, right? So yes, the Buddha didn't mean it in that way. There's another sense of what we call annihilationism. So this is usually a word that we use to translate the word uccedavada from Pali. So annihilationism is essentially the doctrine that there is a self which exists now and which will be ended at some point in the future. So the most common form of annihilationism that we're familiar with is materialist annihilation, right? So myself, is this body. And this body will end when I die, and then that's it. There are other forms of annihilationism as well. For example, there might be an annihilationism based on the idea that you have a fixed number of rebirths and you get born for a certain number of times, and then at the end of that number of times, then you finish. So nothing that you do in the meantime matters. And there were philosophers at the time of the Buddha who taught that, Ajivikas had this idea. And then they were like, ask, if nothing that you do matters, how come you're doing all of these practices? right? Well, because I was destined to do them, not because it makes any difference. Yeah. Anyway, so these kinds of ideas. So is the Buddha's teaching nihilistic in those senses? Then no. So the Buddha said, well, this thing that we think of as a self is we see it through delusion. We misunderstand what it actually is happening. What we're actually seeing is suffering, and that suffering is caused by craving and attachments. And when we let go of craving and attachments, then that suffering comes to an end. So that's something that we can observe. We can observe in ourselves that when we get attached to something, we can feel that tightening, we can feel that suffering. And so we let go just a little bit of that attachment, yeah? And suffering comes to an end. And we keep on going. Every time that we let go of some attachment, some suffering comes to an end. And we keep on doing that. This, again, is why I always encourage people to review at the end of the meditation. And what you are ultimately reviewing is the fact that when you are meditating, right, what it all boils down to, all of those different things that you talk about in meditation, all of those things you think are happening in meditation, all boil down to one thing. When you attach, you'll suffer. And when you let go, that suffering will come to an end. And you see that happening in your meditation countless times in countless different ways, every single time that you meditate. And that is giving you that message. And so then when you see that, you have some faith. And the faith tells you, well, I managed to let go of that suffering. That's pretty good. What about if I was to let go of another bit of suffering? What if I was to let go of another bit of suffering? What if I was to let go of another bit? And so that faith leads you to be able to let go of suffering continually.
All right. Thank you. Can I ask the question?
No.
Am I that
bad? Enough. We've got plenty of other people got asking questions. All right.
Sorry about that.
No, not a problem. Okay. Also enough. I've got quite a few online, and I'm gonna answer these. So I don't do question sessions all that often. So we're gonna try and take these, and we're running out of time. Also, so let's go. Tessa, how's it going, Tessa? I hope you're getting some good coffee. Where is she? Not sure if I can see you there. Oh, there you go. Yeah, Tess, you're having some good coffee? Yes, she's nodding. Okay, excellent. What is your advice for skillful state of mind if one finds oneself suddenly on the verge of possibly dying, e.g. in a car crash? Okay, well, look, I'm going to tell you a story that I heard many years ago when I was in Bonyana. One of the Thai ladies who comes to the monastery all the time came to talk to Ajahn Brahm and told her this story. And she had recently been in a car crash, and she was a passenger, she was in the back seat, the car was T-boned by another car. And she said that, she was somebody who had practiced meditation for many years, right? But not like really super much, right? She'd done like a little bit of meditation every day. And she said that when that car crash happened, as soon as she knew that was happening, she could saw it. And then immediately her mind went inside. And immediately she just went into her meditation, and she had no awareness of the car crash at all. When it came out, it was a terrible crash. People died in that crash and others had critical injuries, and she didn't have a scratch on her. She was perfectly okay. And she came out of that car crash and came out of that meditation, and everything was a mess all around her, obviously. So what that shows is that meditation, again, each time that you're meditating, you are preparing yourself for this. Each time you're meditating, you are conditioning your mind for what is going to matter. The time when it comes time to die, it's too late to start. Well, you can still start, right? It might not be too late, right? Never too late. But it's much better if you've already got a start. And then by the time you come, then you will be ready, yeah? And it will come to you. Yeah. Okay, so Daniel is asking, how much of Dhamma practice is the will and how much is just things as they are with metta? Well, I mean, it relates a little bit to those two stories that I mentioned at the beginning of the meditation, that sometimes we have to do something to fix things and sometimes we have to just let them go. How much of each? Can't say. Also depends on each person. If your nashi orchard is way out of whack, then you have to do more work on it. if it's pretty much okay, then you have to do, you don't have to do so much work. So yeah, that's a kind of question that you really can't answer in a general sense, but we each have to learn for ourselves. So you learn that through mindfulness, through wisdom, and through experience. Nobody can tell you that stuff yourself. Ahmed asks, perfect mental health, and this is that the same as Arahanthood or Buddhahood? I'm currently in trauma recovery with a psychologist. No, it's not really the same thing. So perfect mental health, I'm not sure if that's really a concept. I think in psychology, you don't really think of perfect mental health. You think of pretty good, pretty okay mental health. And the same thing like physical health of your body. Well, if you can get up in the morning and go for a walk, you're not doing too badly. So yeah, we can improve mental health, right? We can become more functional and happier and lighter and all of those things. So arahantship we can say that an arahant has perfect mental health in that sense because they have no greed, hatred, and delusion. But it's not the same thing as what psychologists are talking about when they're talking about mental health. What psychologists are talking about is a mind which is, you know, which is fighting itself, which is dysfunctional, which is trapped in past patterns and so on and so forth. And those things sometimes can be helped through spiritual practice, but it's not quite the same thing. If you're in trauma recovery with a psychologist already, I think this is great, and I think you should keep on doing that. It's not necessarily the same thing as your spiritual path. So sometimes in spiritual practice, people do what we call spiritual bypassing, which is that they actually have trauma or anxieties and things that they need to face and they need to address, but they shove them down and then pretend that they're very spiritually advanced by kind of leaping over them, but somehow it always comes back to bite them in the end. So it's what we call spiritual bypassing. So that's a good thing to avoid. But generally speaking, I would say that through therapy and through psychological work, we can improve our mental health. And when our mental health is usually pretty okay, then our spiritual path can then take that and take it to another level. But just remember that the psychologists are not really talking about the same areas or the same regions that the spiritual path is talking about. Okay. Moving along, Natalia had to leave. Oh, so sorry, Natalia. Bye-bye. Scientists have shut down the LHC and now sitting meditation in order to understand. They say nothing is to be done. I don't think that's the case. I think the Large Hadron Collider is still going. I once almost had the opportunity to go into to meditation class at CERN. Didn't quite happen, though. Okay. We've got some more. In the beginning was the word and what followed. So Daniel says, in the beginning was the word and what followed universally regarded as a bad idea. Anyway, okay. Okay, so that's about it for the questions online, and looking like our time is about to run out. So have we got any questions from the folks who have not yet been able to ask a question? Yeah.
It's more about the practice.
Please.
When you practice meditation,
yeah,
it gives you that feeling that everything is going to be okay.
Okay.
And like you trust this feeling? Should you trust this feeling or should you not trust it? As in, yeah, what if something happens? But always after you finish meditating,
all right,
you get this feeling that everything is going to be okay.
Okay. So when you practice a meditation, you get a feeling that things are going to be okay, and then you're worried about that feeling. Is that right? So maybe don't worry about that feeling, alternatively. So it's good to feel that everything's okay. But on the other hand, it's also true, because that feeling that you have that everything's okay, that's also impermanent. That'll stay for a while and then that'll go away. That's all right.
Until it goes away.
Yeah.
You feel kind of not disappointed, but you know, like,
yeah,
I thought things would be okay and not things are not.
Right, right.
They were for those few minutes.
They were for those few minutes, right? And that's pretty good.
In the present moment.
Yeah, yeah. So if you get, if you can have a few minutes where you feel like everything's okay, I mean, if you could bottle that, I guess that's, I guess they do. That's what they put. That's what they put in bottles, right? So anyway, yeah. So but like when those things happen, we as meditators, right? Then it's important to reflect about that, because that feeling of like worrying about that, the ending of that feeling, that's also, that's another feeling. And that feeling's also impermanent. The worry, the good feeling is impermanent. The worry also is impermanent, right? And so we reflect on, we understand that process. Yeah. And any final questions from from anyone who hasn't had a chance to ask a question yet?
Is that what you were going to say?
No, well, that leaves you out, Sinsin. Is that right? Okay, yeah, anyone? No, pretty good. Shani.
So this is the question that my daughter asked.
Okay.
Rebirth.
Right.
So, what is being transmigrated? So, you are saying that it's a state of consciousness.
Yes.
So, that's that. Okay. Because I was relating, well, I explained to her that there is no self.
Right.
Probably the closest to self is this bundle of the form, the feeling, the perception,
right.
The choice, and then
right.
Is that the right answer?
Sure, yeah, yeah. So you probably know that you know the simile of the fax machine. You probably heard me teach that one before. Do you know the simile of the fax machine? Anyone? Okay, so I'll tell the simile of the fax machine and then we'll call it a night. Okay, so this simile comes from Bhante Gunaratna, the beloved teaching monk in West Virginia. And so he said the rebirth is like sending a fax, okay? So first of all, for any of the younger people here, do we know what a fax is? Okay, anyone, I think people, fax, okay, fine. There was a time when that was like super cutting edge. It's like, wow, it's amazing. Okay, so, here's what happens. So you get a piece of paper. That paper has information on it, right? This has writing. The writing conveys a certain meaning, right? You then put that in the fax machine. The fax machine scans it, converts that into digital information, right? Ones and zeros, ultimately. So then you go and you make a connection with another fax machine, and then you send that information to the other fax machine. But nothing physically actually goes from your machine to the other machine. So when we talk about like electricity flowing from one place to another, it doesn't really flow like water flows, but the potentials are transferred. What actually is transferred is a pattern, actually. So patterns of ones and zeros that are transferred. Then that arrives at the other fax machine. The other fax machine receives those ones and zeros. And ones and zeros, of course, just on and off, right? Then it interprets those and it prints out another sheet of paper. Yeah, that sheet of paper has not one atom in common with that first sheet of paper, and nothing has transferred from this one place to the other except for the pattern of information. It prints out that other one. That paper is not the same as the previous one, right? There's always, faxes are not perfect. There's always some imperfections, some marks and blurry bits and so on, but the meaning of the words is the same. The message is the same. Yeah. So the meaning is transferred, even though nothing physical has transferred from one place to the other. So this is the Buddhist theory of rebirth, right? It's about information transfer, systems, and so on. So a soul theory, okay, now if we were to apply the soul theory to the fax machine, how a soul theory works is that inside the fax machine lives a little man. And when you put the fax sheet in there, the little man reads the fax sheet, memorizes it, okay, and then very quickly runs down the phone line, arrives all puffed out at the other end. That's the noise that you hear. The noise. It's a little man. He's so puffed out. And he gets to the other side, and then he writes out a new message, which then comes out the other fax machine. That's a soul theory, right? And so the Buddhist theory is always thinking in terms of cause and effect, in terms of systems, in terms of changes and networks. It's a naturalistic theory of the mind and the change of the mind. And so that, to me, that's a really good metaphor. Actually, that metaphor draws on similar metaphors that we find in, say, Visuddhimagga talks about the use of a seal. So like for stamping wax and so on and things. So these also similar kind of ideas that you're transferring information but without actually physically transferring anything. So, yeah, so this is the fax machine simile for rebirth. Okay. So Beck is congratulating me for my impersonation of a fax machine. Oh, Beck, that's very kind. That's the nicest thing someone said to me all day. That's very very nice. Okay, so look, we should wrap up and make sure that we get out in time for our lovely staff here to get home to their families, and also for you guys. So thank you so much for coming. It's been a pleasure to spend some time with you. Thanks so much, Venerable Kusalachara, for joining us for today. You're back to Sri Lanka on Sunday. Okay, so we wish you all the best. And I think on behalf of the Sydney Buddhist community, just to let you know that you always have a home here. If you're ever back or whatever, just look us up and we'll look after you or whatever you need, okay? So I'll be back here next week. Also Tuesdays at Parramatta, that's at the 5 at 6. God, I can't believe that for the rest of my life I'm going to be saying this. At the 5 Library in Parramatta, that's 5 Parramatta Square at 6 p.m. And also we have our retreat in Broken Hill or past Broken Hill. So we still possibly have one or two places there. So if you're interested to go out into the middle of the Australian outback and experience altered states of consciousness, then come and join us, because this is a rare opportunity. I know, look, living in Australia, most people don't get to the outback very often. So take the chance to come out to the outback and expand your mind. All right. So thanks, everybody, and may you be happy. And hang on, we will see you again next week. Okay, very good.
You're right.
Auntie, thank you for being patient with me.
Not a problem.